Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Israeli-British chef and restaurateur Yoram Odelengi has a cult following when it comes to his gorgeous, flavorful, and fresh dishes that reinvent Middle Eastern flavors. In his new cookbook, Odelengi Simple, a cookbook, he presents 130 streamlined recipes, all simple in at least one way, made in 30 minutes or fewer, with 10 or fewer ingredients, in a single pot, using pantry staples, or prepared ahead of time for brilliant, delicious, simple meals. Divided into 7 sections, Simple has ideal recipes for any occasion, from a dinner party to a quick, hassle-free weeknight meal. Yoram Odelengi has authored 7 cookbooks and won several awards, including 2 James Beard Awards. Odelengi Simple is published by 10 Speed, and I'm happy to welcome Yoram Odelengi to All of It. Nice to see you.
Hi.
So your recipes have a reputation for being gorgeous and complex, and you're self-aware to know this. Enough that you know that people say this about your recipes. You wrote in your book, for anyone wondering, Odelengi Simple is not a contradiction in terms. I know. I've seen the raised eyebrows. I've heard the jokes. So how did you go about simplifying your recipes for us mortal folk?
Well, to be honest, I didn't really simplify. I just started from scratch. So I sat down with my collaborators on this book, Tara Wigley and Esme Howarth, and we just decided to not take old recipes and try to simplify them or pare them down, because that felt like a compromise. Really, we just sat down and thought, okay, what do we like to do and we can cook easily when we come home from work? And all sorts of tricks and things using canned chickpeas and other frozen peas and things like that. And the conversation just rolled. And in some ways, what I thought was maybe not sophisticated enough for a cookbook ended up being filling up the pages of this book, because it's not so much about paring down recipes. It's about how you cook when you have not that much time to cook or not so many ingredients to cook with. It's weekday cooking, really, is what I had in mind. So the idea for the book, like you said, it's to find different ways in which you can call a recipe simple, because I don't think there's one. What is simple for you is not simple for me. So there's different cooks in this world, and we all have different levels of skill, different anxieties. So when we walk into the kitchen, we bring all this with us. And the recipes in this book are trying to address all sorts of cooks. So if you're kind of a make ahead kind of person, someone that loves when they entertain or have people over to get everything ready and then just toss it all together or warm it up, then you're an M kind of person.
Yes, we should say that the simple, it's an acronym or a mnemonic device. There's, what's S stand for?
S stands for short on time, less than half an hour to cook the recipe from start to finish.
I
stands for ingredients 10 or less. So a short list of ingredients, especially for Odelengi cooks, that's very little. The M, as I said, is make ahead. The P in simple is for pantry. So those are the sort of recipes that you cook out of what you got in your cupboard, rice, pasta, you know.
Basics.
Couscous, yeah, basics. The L is lazy. It's not the cook.
Lazy? Straight up lazy?
It's not a cook. It's a state of mind. It's what you do when you put something in the oven, like a roast or a stove or something on the stovetop, like a stew, and you come back after 2-3 hours and it's all ready for you. So you can be lazy or read a book or do something while the food does its own cooking. And the E stands for easier than you think. Mm-hmm. So those are the kind of recipes where you think, oh, actually, I don't make ice cream because I don't have an ice cream machine, or I don't bake bread because it's just too complicated. But in actual fact, there are recipes that are much less convoluted than you think they are. So the S-I-M-P-L-E are all different ways in which a dish can be simple. And many of the recipes are in this book are simple in more than one way. They could be an M and an I. So a make ahead and something that only has few ingredients.
Yeah, it's really interesting on top of the recipes. They almost look like subway letters.
Yes.
They have the S M and the I,
it's
or
fun,
the S
and
the
colorful.
L. Yeah, yeah. When people tell you they don't cook, what reasons do they give? Are they all those reasons you just mentioned? Or
look, there are people that don't cook, and I never judge people for not cooking. I think it's absolutely fine not to cook, especially if you live in a place where there's a lot of opportunities, you know, restaurant and takeout places. It's absolutely fine. But I think cooking is a joy. And unless you don't cook for the right reason, there's a completely good reasons. Like I said, if you're way too busy, then it's fine. But if you don't cook because you're a bit scared of cooking, or you have never tried it and you think, oh, that's just not for me, I think that's not a good reason. It's a good reason to try. And I hope that in this book I give people lots of, or 130 odd reasons to go into the kitchen, get the machines out, or even just the knife and the chopping board and get cooking.
We're speaking with Yotam Ottolenghi about his new book, Ottolenghi Simple, a cookbook. I'm interested about make-ahead foods. Do they all have something in common?
Well, the thing that they have in common is that you have at least one or two elements within the dish, and sometimes the whole dish itself, that wouldn't spoil over time. So you can leave it either at room temperature or in the fridge for a while, and when you come to serve it, it's as good as it was when you just made it. So if you think of something like, I've got two recipes for meatballs. One is in a tomato ricotta meatballs in a tomato kind of sauce, and the other is are more lemony, and they have celery root and a kind of a really beautiful sharp broth that they sit in. Both those dishes are absolutely fine the next day, even a little bit better. So, you know, so those are the kind of things that you think really there's absolutely no need to stress when you have people over for dinner, because you make that and you can even triple or quadruple the recipe and freeze it or chill it for the whole week. And when people come over, you just put it out there, you steam some rice, and you're ready to serve a perfectly delicious meal. And the one thing that I really think is really important to bear in mind is that one of the things we often forget is that cooking should be fun. And if you've made something a million times before, you're really good at it and you're in a relaxed state of mind. And then when you cook, you're happy and everybody around you is happy. On the other hand, if you cook something for the first time, especially if people come over or you serve
I wouldn't do that to my friends. I'd have to try it once before they came over.
Exactly. And so this is exactly the right approach. And people really appreciate it. They'd much rather eat something they've had before and you being a happy host than you reinventing yourself as a chef or as a cook a minute before they come.
Oh, a stressed out host is the worst.
It's the worst.
Because as a guest, then you feel bad. Should I help? Should I not?
Yeah.
Why did she do this to her? He or she do this to himself? There are vegetarian dishes in the book, not specifically meant to be vegetarian, where a vegetable, what does it take for a vegetable to be the center of a meal, where it can sustain as a main?
Well, I think that for me, the whole business of start a main course dessert is a little bit biased, because in a sense, I think any vegetable could be as a main, and any dish that has vegetables in it could be served as a main course. It's just about what you serve around it. So in this particular book, I've got 70% of the recipes in the book roughly are vegetarian. But if you make something like a stir-fried cabbage with garlic and chili, which is just, I just happened to scroll through the book and find it, but the book is full of them. Essentially, that feels to so many people like a side dish, but it really isn't a side dish. It's a whole world of flavors. There is garlic and chili and onions and a good cabbage. And that served with rice, for me, is absolutely fine as a main course. You don't have to have a clear protein, but if you want to have it, you add a poached egg, which is my solution to everything if you're not a vegan. And there you go. You've got a whole meal. So what I'm saying is the whole people give up the idea of a main course. Any vegetable dish could be a main course or the center of a meal.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest today is Yotam Ottolenghi. His new book is Ottolenghi Simple, a cookbook. We have one of your recipes on our website, braised eggs with leek and za'atar. Mm. Okay, so people are going to think, braising does not sound simple. Hold our hand through braising. Hold my hand through braising.
Braising is nothing like we all do it all the time. The moment you put a piece of meat or a piece of fish in a sauce and leave it there to cook, you've braised it. Essentially, it's like a nicer word for boiling. So this is one of my favorite dishes. And, you know, I love eggs for breakfast. But if you want to make a meal out of an eggs for breakfast, you cook them in something else. So many of your listeners probably would have heard of a shakshuka, which is eggs that are cooked in a tomato sauce. It's a North African dish that has become so popular that it's in every possible menu across the land. So this is a green equivalent of a shakshuka. So you take some leeks, you chop them up, you saute them with butter and olive oil, and then you add a bit of stock or water if you like, some chopped up lemon or preserved lemon. And once this is all nice and thick, you break a few eggs in there and some feta cheese. And within 6 minutes, the eggs are semi-cooked and you've got a wonderful breakfast dish that all you need to serve alongside is some bread to mop it all up. So that's braising in 3 seconds.
I mentioned za'atar. Am I saying that correctly?
Za'atar, yeah.
Za'atar. I cooked with it last night, not because I knew what it was. It was because it became in one of those meal service kits.
Oh, yeah.
It helps me along, helps some of us who like to cook, but, you know, need a little assistance.
My sympathies.
We're busy with new jobs, so we need a little bit of help. What is za'atar exactly? And if I'm sitting at home and I'm listening to this and you're not in New York City and you're not in an international city, how do I find these things?
Yeah. Well, the one thing I always want to say when people follow my recipes, one ingredient in the recipe and it's not the core ingredient, it's not the cauliflower in a cauliflower dish, very often you can substitute or lose it. And often I offer substitute. So for za'atar, if you can't get za'atar, you can sprinkle some dried thyme or dried oregano, a bit of some sesame seeds and some olive oil and you're absolutely fine, or even one of the above, not all of them. But za'atar is a spice blend that I grew up with. It's a wonderful thing that is very common. I grew up in Israel, in Lebanon, in Palestine. You know, those are ingredients that are it's a herb that's dried, a bit like marjoram or oregano. It's called za'atar. And when it's dried and crushed, it becomes into a powder. And to that powder, we add sesame seeds toasted, a bit of salt, and some sumac, which is another local spice. And that is a sharp and spicy and earthy spice
that
you sprinkle over anything, really.
Yes. I did it over beef. It was quite delicious. In your book, you differentiate between everyday ingredients and then otolenghi ingredients.
Yeah.
What's the difference?
Well, I guess what it is that I love really kind of far out exotic ingredients that throw in a lot of flavor into a dish. And often they're not really always available to people if they're not in the city center or they have a great shop next to them. So those are the kind of the exotic ingredients that I say to people, those are the otolenghi ingredients. They offer a lot of flavor for very little work. So the za'atar we mentioned is one of them. Preserved lemon is another one, which are essentially lemons that have been left to kind of ferment and do their work over time. And then you've got both acidity, but also a kind of a mature lemon flavor. So there's a bunch of harissa, which is a chili, it's a Tunisian or North African chili paste. Those are all ingredients that have a lot of flavor. And what I said at the beginning of the book, I said, those are my 10 ingredients for this particular book. If you buy them, and they're not expensive, but you can order them online or find them in certain Middle Eastern shops, you can have them in your cupboard and then you can cook tons of recipes from this book. So you don't go out to buy one ingredient for this particular dish. You buy the 10 ingredients and you can cook, you know, 30, 40, 50 recipes in this book over time. So people won't complain and say, how come I had to go and buy this za'atar and I use half a teaspoon and it sits there rotting in my cabin, in my spice cabinet. No, if you buy it in this book, it will take you quite far.
It's interesting that you mentioned lemons and fermentation, because this week we've had in Rene Redzepi, who has his new book out about fermentation. And
he's
also
a hero.
Dori Greenspan, who talked about lemon goop that she makes as the base for all her vinaigrettes.
She's also a hero.
Yeah, sort of. It's sort of interesting. It's the week of the lemon here.
Yeah.
What is it about lemons in their various states that make them so universal?
I can talk
universal?
About this forever.
You can talk about lemons
lemon
forever?
Lemon is my middle name. So... And it's actually on the cover. I've got a big lemon on the cover of my British edition this book. And essentially, lemons, I think they are so special because, like you suggest, you can do they can go, you can go through a whole panoply of activities with them. So for the start, we're all familiar with a bit of lemon zest or skin thrown over a stew or salad and just giving it a nice sharpness, and lemon juice, obviously, which is you know, it's the juice of heaven. But then when you start roasting lemons or slow cooking them, or even just leaving them with a bunch of salt to start ferment and turn into what we call preserved lemon or pickled lemon, you've got aromatic oils in the skin that over time really mature and turn really perfumey. And this is where I think lemon really comes to its own after it's been left in its own juices with some salt to mature. And then you taste it and you go, wow, that is lemon like I've never tried it before. And there's also dried lemons. If you go to the Gulf or to Persia, you find lemons laid out in the sun and left to dry until they go rock mm-hmm. black. And that's the sharpest powder you've ever tasted once you've ground it down. And that's another version of lemon. So really, there's endless options. And so someone who loves playing with food, I mean, lemon is the ultimate trick.
It's also so interesting in different cultures how and what they do with the food and how it then appears in the food. I was in Jordan, and I just remember a family with tomatoes on the roof, just drying the tomatoes. You would go up on the roof, and you could just see all the families had put their tomatoes out. And it was both beautiful, and then you realize, oh, this is going to be part of their meals for the rest of the week.
I mean, tomatoes and lemons are quite similar that you know, they you get quite a lot, and you need to find things to do with it. I mean, it's true about many things, but tomatoes and lemons are very particular. My parents have one lemon tree in their garden, and the amount of lemon my mom gets from that tree is insane. So you constantly need to find things to do with them. So drying, obviously, it means you can, you know, keep on using them for the rest of the year.
I want to ask about a couple more recipes and then about dessert. We're speaking with Yotam Ottolenghi about his new book, Ottolenghi. We're speaking with Yoram Ogolenghi. Let me check one time.
That's a typical thing that happens to many people.
I'm going to do it. We're speaking with Yotam Ottolenghi. His name of his new cookbook is Ottolenghi Simple, a cookbook. You have a dish in here that you call the ultimate family dish, gnocchi alla romana. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, this is the one dish that I can go on and on about, because it's my grandmother was Italian, and I remember very clearly, it's one of those vivid childhood memories, coming into her kitchen and smelling melted cheese. And I knew that gnocchi alla romana, that was what she was making. So gnocchi alla romana essentially is not gnocchi in the sense that most people know, which are potato dumplings. It's made out of semolina. It's semolina that's cooked like porridge with some milk and butter and nutmeg and cheese. And once you finish cooking it, you spread it out on a tray. And it sets, and you take circles and put them on a baking tray and put some more cheese on top and put it under the grill until it melts. So it's just the most evocative, delicious, yummy thing you can imagine, which really, it's the dumplings are just carriers for great melted Parmesan cheese. And if there's one dish you want to cook from this book, it's the gnocchi alla romana, because it really kind of captures my childhood and is the ultimate comfort dish.
It sounds like it's the one you love the most.
I do love that dish very much. It's got a personal story attached, so that's a good start.
What is your philosophy on dessert?
What is my philosophy on dessert? So this book has desserts, and I think for me there's two types of desserts. Under the section desserts, there's desserts and there's cakes. And I think those are two very different things. So a cake is something that you could have instead of a dessert. So when you finish a meal, you can have a slice of cake and a cup of tea, or even without the tea. But a dessert is something that is absolutely, you cannot have it with a cup of tea or coffee. It's something creamy and luscious and complex and multi-layered that you have at the end of the meal to kind of accentuate the whole meal. So one of the desserts that I absolutely love in this book is a custard. And I beg the listeners to try this custard, because once they've made it, they'll never stop making it. Because when you think of custard, you think, oh, that's something quite complicated and not so straightforward. But in actual fact, this one has got about four ingredients: cream, egg yolk, some cornstarch, vanilla. And you put it in the oven, and within 40 minutes, you've got a beautiful, wobbly, semi-set custard that you could eat almost like that, but it's really nice to let it sit and kind of set a little bit more. And then you can have it with fresh fruit or with poached fruit. In this particular case, it's with roasted rhubarbs and strawberries to die for. It's so good.
New Yorkers are serious about their cheesecake.
Oh, well, that...
And you suggest in here honey yogurt set cheesecake.
That is so good. It's got thyme in it, and it's really light and fluffy. And there's another cheesecake there, but it's a deconstructed cheesecake. So it's a bit of cheesecake mix with a crumble on top and some roasted cherries. That's another option for all the cheesecake-loving New Yorkers.
And let me ask you about cake, since you separated the two.
So cake. So I like a really nice sponge, something that you could have. So it's got just enough flavor to go really well with a cup of hot beverage. This is my idea of having like a 3 o'clock in the afternoon, a cup of tea or coffee, and like a lemon and blueberry cake, of which there's one here in the book, or an apple cake. And those are like, these are like, this is when you take time during the day and you sit down and say, okay, I'm not really announcing that that's a meal or anything, but I just want a celebration for, you know, 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And that's what cakes are for.
It's interesting talking to you, Yotam, as you describe the food, because some of it really clearly sings to your heart, and you wrote about it because it means something to you. And then also hearing stories about the Italian grandmother, but you're growing in Israel, but you're British. You clearly spent time in America. Is the internationalness of you seen in this book?
Yes, definitely. Myself and my collaborator, because I'm a massive collaborator. I hardly ever work on my own. And the people that I work with, each one brings their own story. So this is a collaboration between myself and two co-authors. But it also tells the story of a lot of people that work in my kitchens, in my restaurants in London, that have great ideas. And I always love finding out great ideas from them, because in a sense, when you don't work in your own bubble, you learn so much. So those stories are really important. And London being such an international place, and kitchens by definition being international places, because they draw everyone from all over the world, because anyone can cook, but not even without even speaking the language. So yeah, I love that. And I love the idea that my books are international, and I'm never going to stop because I don't know any other language. It's just that kind of mixed language that we all love and enjoy.
And it's fascinating now that I think, you know, maybe 15, 20 years ago, we couldn't have had this conversation about sitar because no one could get it. But with the internet, it's really opened up a world for
Absolutely.
Cooks everywhere.
Because people are having conversations so easily these days about things. And as soon as someone discovers some odd chili paste in Korea, they just want to have it here and now. And in our world, it's actually possible. So this is why all these international conversations have immediate consequences on menus all across the globe. And it is a really wonderful thing.
The name of the book is Otolenghi Simple, a cookbook. Yotam Otolenghi, thanks for joining us on all of it.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure.
Hi, I'm Allison Stewart, and you are listening to WNYC. Here at All of It, we often like to tell you about film festivals, cultural festivals, food festivals. Today, we want to talk to you about a festival focusing on the end of life. For the next week in New York City, the Reimagine End of Life Festival will be taking place across all 5 boroughs. It's a week-long examination about death, rituals, and emotions. The event runs from this Sunday, October 27th, to November 3rd. You can catch the events not just in theaters, but in hospitals and senior citizen centers and cemeteries. Among the festival's headliners are Tracy K. Smith, the United States Poet Laureate, and Frank Ostaseski, hope I said his name right, an author and end-of-life educator. I'm so pleased it brings Brad Wolf, the event founder, to the show, along with comedian Chris Garcia, who is performing opening night. Welcome, you guys.
Hey.
Hey, thanks for having us.
So, Brad, where did the idea for this festival come from?
Yeah, so, you know, personally, I lost somebody when I was in my early 20s who was diagnosed with a rare form of pediatric cancer. And when she was sick in the hospital, I was a closet musician at the time, writing songs in my bedroom, and started bringing my guitar with me to the hospital to play music for her. And just seeing the way that when people talk about the power of art and creativity, you don't really know what that means until you see it in action when it affects somebody's life in that way. So to see Sarah, the way it made her, just lifted her spirits during those times and become a language for myself to communicate. Thereafter, she inspired me to pursue music more, and I would then be asked to write songs for other young people with who are facing the end of life and showing up. You know, sadly, in some cases, they would pass away as well, and I would be asked to reprise the song that I'd written for them at their funerals. And looking out into the sea of people that I didn't know celebrating the life of a child, it was really hard. But it made me think, why is it that we have to wait? Why do we wait till after the fact to celebrate the people that we love? And it was that question, really, that has subsequently driven me and this amazing team I have to think about how to bring art and creativity and ritual, bring people in to have these conversations that might inspire people to do that now.
When you talk to people about trying to have these conversations, why do you think people are so uncomfortable with it?
I think in our culture here, it's death and even aging and old people, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind in a lot of our society. We death is something that happens in a hospital under white walls. We don't live with our elders like cultures used to. And as spirituality and religion, maybe we become a little bit more secular. Talking about death is something that's not really part of the fabric of our lives, and it's not really woven into who we are. So we tend to want to just put tubes in people and keep people alive as long as we can, but we're not really thinking about how to always like love each other all the way up until the end.
Now, Chris, how did you get involved with this project?
Well, I have been talking, last year Reimagine had a similar type of event in San Francisco, which is where I started doing comedy. And I've been talking about my father, who's had Alzheimer's until he died last year. I've been talking about it pretty publicly on stage for the last couple of years. And I guess, Brad, is that how you heard of me?
Oh, yeah, I just have heard of you. No, that's how I heard of you. No, I think you're hilarious.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
And so Brad asked me to do this, and I was really surprised and really excited about it because usually as a stand-up, I don't really get to talk about death all the time, especially if I'm like headlining a Yuck Yucks in Alaska or something. It seems like it's kind of a bummer to some people. Or if I'm doing a show at a bar and there's karaoke in the background, it's not very appropriate. But, you know, Brad asked me to perform at the opening ceremony and to headline the punchline last year, which gave me an opportunity to talk about this at length for like about an hour. And I found it to be one of the most like beautiful cathartic experiences I've ever had on stage, just because the crowd was completely on board. The first night at SF Jazz last year, there's like 700 people in the crowd, and it felt like I was just in a room full of friends. And I think it's because people are generally uncomfortable to talk about death, but we were all there. Especially, I felt like after my dad died, friends would check in on me for like a month or so. And then it's such a weird thing to be like, hey, how you doing with your dead dad stuff? Yeah. But it felt like everyone was there for a reason and totally on board. And it was just such a beautiful connection between all the performers and the crowd. And it was just really a special night. So I'm very excited to perform at the opening ceremony this weekend. I think it's going to be great.
We're speaking with Chris Garcia, that we was just talking, and Brad Wolf, who is the founder of the Reimagine End of Life Festival. So, Brad, can you describe what some of the events are going to be? I mean, people must be thinking, festival, how does this work with the serious topic?
Yeah, so we as you just heard from Chris, I mean, we're approaching it from all these different angles, and it really is bubbling up from the community. So there's 350 events at letsreimagine.org, 75% of which are actually free.
Wonderful.
And there's really something for everyone. So as Chris mentioned, at opening night, for example, which is at Merkin Hall at the Coffin Music Center on Saturday, Chris will be performing, which will be amazing. And then there's also music, there's gospel music, there's an event at the 9/11 Memorial site on Friday, where we're collectively building an altar out of flowers, to honor, just think about loss in general and celebrate our lives and bring people together in that way. There's, events at hospitals, there's events at churches, at music venues, every which way you go across New York City, you're going to find something that relates to something that you care about.
And is it a multicultural experience?
Totally multicultural. That's the other thing that we work really hard to invite every different community in to this experience. So there's events in Mandarin. There's events in Spanish. And also it's intergenerational. So as you mentioned, there's events in community centers and senior citizen centers and for millennials. And to bring us all together, because there's something fun and meaningful about coming together with different people. And death is something in its universality that in times, you know, with the election coming up, there's like not very many things that can bring people mm-hmm. together. But, and it seems weird that death would be one of those things, but it really turns out to be not a morbid affair, but something that lifts people's spirits.
Chris, let me bring you back into the conversation. You know, it's interesting. We've been got Kenneth Lonergan on in the next hour, and his new play is autobiographical. It's the Waverly Gallery, about his grandmother's decline. She was a very vibrant woman with dementia. And obviously, Sandra Day O'Connor this week, she announced that she has Alzheimer's. Can you describe a little bit what that experience was like as your father was nearing the end of his life? Because as I've heard people describe it, and I've seen it personally, is the person still the person? They're still there in many ways, but the decline sort of frays them at the edges, initially anyway.
Yeah, I think that's a good description. It is a gruesome, slow, and painful death where you see someone disappear before your eyes. Like at first, they'll kind of, you know, they'll get a little loopy, forget their keys. Every once in a while, they'll call you by a different name. And then suddenly, they become aware that they're losing their mind. They might become violent. They get very frustrated. Then they start wandering off. And slowly but surely, they start losing their dignity. They become completely incompetent. They forget how to eat. And my father had it for 10 years, and he devolved from being this very smart, strong man, and he devolved into a child. He couldn't do anything by himself. But what I learned is that he was a very beautiful child. Like, he became like a very, it's just like seeing him be a little kid again, where he would like crawl around, but he would still pat me on the back every once in a while and give me a kiss. And it was actually, it's very sad, but it's very funny. Like, he forgot, this sounds silly, but he forgot what farts were. And so he would fart and he would forget, and it would be a little surprise for him because he forgot what farts were, and he would giggle and laugh, and it would all give us a good laugh. And even when he forgot when my mom was, like, I tell this story about how he forgot who my mom was one day, and he, as my mom would say, he got very handsy with her, and he's like, he tried to kiss her, and he stopped himself, and he said, "I don't know if I can do this. I have a wife and two kids."
Aw.
So,
that's so...
So I learned, my dad has a type, and also he's a gentleman because he didn't go through with it.
It's so interesting to hear you speak, Chris, because you clearly are a storyteller, and you're able to see this difficult time in your life, but able to create and craft a story out of it to share with other people. I don't know if you are doing that purposely or if that's a personal coping mechanism.
I think it's a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. I think when you're going through a situation like this and seeing someone in decline in such a painful way, there's a lot of ways to cope, and one way is just kind of spinning your own positive narrative on it. But I think overall it was a terrible experience, but it was a positive one. To see, it really brought my family together in a way that I communicated with my mother and sister in a way that was so beautiful, and we put so much care into my father, and it was such an intimate experience, and to finally care so much for him and guide him into the next stage after life was a very beautiful family moment that I think I'm very proud of for my family. Laughing about things like that, like my dad trying to cheat on my mom with my mom and him forgetting farts, was so helpful and so beautiful, which was why I'm so excited to talk about stuff like this tomorrow. It's just because I found it very cathartic, and I think it will be cathartic for others as well.
And the cool thing I think about Chris that really inspires me, and about comedy itself as a medium to communicate this type of stuff, is that I like to say that grief as an emotion is more like a Jackson Pollock painting. It's like all the colors. It's not just darkness and sadness. There's laughter and there's joy and there's the pain too. But with comedy and with Chris, mm-hmm. he can go from like that light to dark in the midst of 10 seconds in a joke, and then also make you feel something. And I think that to me is why I'm so excited to have Chris, and then why these different lenses and different ways in through the arts are so powerful, because each one brings up something different in how you come to the conversation.
We're speaking with Brad Wolf, the founder of the Reimagine End of Life Festival, and Chris Garcia, who will be performing the opening night. Something I think is interesting, I was cruising around the website, you know, they always say funerals are for the living. And there's a lot of sort of things that we can do now while we're here. That a lot of there are classes in how to write a condolence letter, and a class in how to write your own obituary. What were the ideas behind having these classes?
Yeah, so the cool thing about all these events is what Reimagine's done is we've basically turned to the New York City community and said, what events do you want to create? And these are things that have bubbled up that people across the city are already working on. Mm-hmm. People have ritualized this topic and thought about it in their own way. And so for us to be able to offer them to everybody here to learn how now we might think about this question of why wait? Mm-hmm. Why do we wait to think about how we want to be remembered? Why do we wait to tell the people in our lives that we love them? These are the types of things that classes about condolence letters and giving people more of these tools now mm-hmm. might help us all kind of live better today.
And Chris, I wanted to ask you.
I really wish I would have done that sort of class. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No,
but
please.
That would have been so useful for me because my father's eulogy, I ate it so hard. Someone was like, you better write this down. A comedian friend of mine was like, write it down because you're going to lose it. I was like, I've been speaking professionally about my father for 12 years. Thank you very much. I think I got this. And then I just blew it. I just cried the entire time and awkwardly sat down. And I knew I was a comedian because for the rest of the service, all I was thinking was about getting back on stage. I was like, my opener was terrible. I didn't even close on anything. And it's been haunting me ever since.
I think you're doing a pretty good job celebrating your dad, you know. That's pretty cool.
And before I let you both go, as two people who've been through this festival, already happened happened in San Francisco, what advice would you give to someone coming to the festival who's listening to this and thinking, man, this might be for me, but I don't know if I like the tone or I'm uncomfortable having these conversations because maybe I do have a parent in hospice. Chris, what advice would you give?
Bring some Kleenex. No, don't bring any Kleenex. It's going to be fine. You're in good hands. It's going to be a celebration of life. It's not going to be like a sad eulogy or anything. So just come out and be prepared to have a nice time. That's what I would say.
Yeah, and I would just say just show up, people. I mean, honestly, when we first did this, I prototyped this in San Francisco a couple years ago, and there was only 30 events. Now we have 350. I thought maybe it was going to be sad and depressing. And honestly, when I saw the reaction of everyone who came and how meaningful and uplifting and connected people felt and people were able to meet new people and just the whole spirit of the thing, which is the spirit of just people, just blew my mind. So it's kind of a unique, marvelous experience. And usually people say there's something hard. Try to move toward that thing is another piece of good advice I've received over the years.
And if people want more information, where should they go?
Let'sreimagine.org. Let'sreimagine.org. And we have 350 events there. You check it out. 75% are free. It's for everyone.
And Chris, you want to say one more thing before we go?
Just be prepared to call someone you love on speed dial afterwards.
That is a good
piece
of
advice. It's a nice feeling.
Chris Garcia and Brad Wolf, thank you so much for joining us on All of It and for sharing all this information.
Thank you so much. See you, Chris.
Thank you so much. See you, Brad. See you tomorrow.
You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. And maybe you dreamed of becoming a professional musician when you grew up. Maybe you took lessons and played for several years just for fun or because your parent made you. Then you grew up, got a job, took on commitments, and your music aspirations went by the wayside. Our next guest wants you to reconsider your relationship with music. In her book, Making Time for Making Music, How to Bring Music into Your Busy Life, Amy Nathan guides the reader towards incorporating playing music into everyday life. I'm thrilled she's able to join us here today, and Amy has offered to take some calls and dispense some advice.
All right.
Amy, welcome. Listeners, are you an amateur musician? We want to hear from you. Where do you like to go to play music? How do you strike the balance between music and your obligations? You can call us at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Or you can tweet us at all of it. WNYC. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
So you've written books about kids and getting your kids involved in music, but what inspired you to specifically look at adult amateur musicians?
Well, it was partly from the two books that I wrote. One was for kids, the other one was for music parents, and I began to realize that people really didn't know about this other aspect of music, that you could make music as an adult even if you weren't a professional musician. And so I began to research it, and I found that many of the people that I was going to interview for the book, the non-professional musicians, even they hadn't realized it initially, and it took them a long time to realize there were all these options out there for people to make music, no matter, you know, whether you're a professional musician or not.
When you spoke to people, what did they say were the biggest obstacles towards making music as an adult?
Okay, one was not knowing there was a way to do it. But the two was there was a self-confidence gap. Hmm. A lot of it left over from less than positive experiences as a kid. You know, maybe they had a music teacher who was too strict and sort of killed the joy of music for them. Or maybe they didn't get into an ensemble they really wanted to get into, and they thought, well, I guess that shows that I'm not really for music. And several of them had aspirations to be professionals, and when that didn't work out, they thought, well, how can I just do it part way? So it took all of them a while to come up with how to do it, and they did eventually overcome those obstacles.
For all our musicians out there, we do want to hear from you. Where do you like to go to play? Do you need advice on getting music back in your life? Our number is 212-433-9692. The number is 212-433-WNYC, or you can tweet something to us at all of it WNYC. So you did research for this book. You created this questionnaire for musicians. What kind of questions were on the questionnaire, and what were you trying to find out?
Well, I made the questionnaire very open-ended because I really just wanted them just to talk about what their experience had been. But I asked them, you know, did you do music as a kid? You know, did you do it in college and so forth? And how are you doing it today? But I also asked them, you know, what obstacles, you know, did you face in making music? What problems and what advice would you have for others? And they were really very open, giving lots of good advice for other people. And this was a long questionnaire, mm-hmm. and about 300 people filled it out. And it was really wonderful that they did, because they had wonderful advice for other people.
They seem to have gone into three groups: those who have played, those who played at children and stopped, and then people who were new to playing.
Right, right. There were some that had been making music all along. They never stopped. Others put it aside, usually when they became parents or had a very demanding job and there just wasn't time. But there are some who just, you know, started totally new. There's this 70-year-old woman in Cincinnati who one day she woke up with an overwhelming desire to play the violin. And she did, and now she switched at 76 to viola. So she really proves that there's no limit to when you can start making music.
We're speaking with Amy Nathan. The name of her book is Making Time for Music. Brandon called us from Astoria. Hi, Brandon.
Hi, how are you? Can you hear me?
We can. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Big fan of the show. I listen every day.
Thanks.
I am a... amateur musician, as you can call it. I play ukulele, guitar, and piano for various groups throughout the city. One of the places I wanted to point out is the U-Cut. We are a ukulele-only music store. We're the only one on the East Coast. It's out here in Astoria. And we got open mic every Sunday, and that's some of the best places where I find people can play. Especially on the amateur level, you know, there's open mics almost at every single venue at least once a week. I always say that's the best way to get your name out there in the city.
Great advice, Brandon. Thank you so much. Amy, to your point about the confidence gap, I have to admit, I'm somebody who has taken piano as a kid, and then I stopped, and I've back and forth. And ever since I started this fantastic new job, I've not taken my piano lessons on Fridays, which used to happen at 4. Haven't done it in 3 months. I'm embarrassed. So this is a little bit of a therapy session for me. What advice would you, I'm a shy player. I have a hard time playing in front of people. If someone wanted to go to an open mic and wanted to play, but were frightened, what advice can you give them?
Well, I think lower your expectations, and just showing up there and just playing something would be an accomplishment. But maybe go to the open mics a couple of times on your own, and you'll see that maybe not everybody is as polished as you might imagine, and then there might be room for you too. So work on bolstering your self-confidence. Maybe there are amateur, I try not to use that word, but because it has sort of a whiff of being not quite serious, and some of the people in the book objected to that word. So I try to use avocational or non-pro. So anyhow, so there are support groups, meetup support group, one very active one called ACMA. They meet regularly, and people play for each other. And there can be no criticism. Just support and encouragement. So that might be something to start with, to go and just play in front of some other struggling avocational musicians and build up your self-confidence, and then before you hit the open mic.
And what about the issue of time? Time, I mean, practice, practice, practice. I have trouble getting even one practice in.
Right, right. Well, everybody, 5% of the people didn't practice at all. They just hated practice and they weren't going to do it. And they were good enough sight readers that they could go to their ensemble rehearsals without practicing. But the others did practice, some not every day, not for an hour at a time. But they tried to fit it in the little nooks and crannies of the day. Like this one woman has it called the roast in the oven plan. So she's a working mom, and she comes home and she chops everything up. She puts it in a pot, sticks it in the oven. So while it's cooking, she practices. So there's another very good piece of advice is take the 5 minutes that are available. Don't wait for the hour that will never materialize. And so leave the lid of your piano open with the piece that you really like to play sitting out on it. Who knows, you might just do a couple of measures.
I love that. Take the 5 minutes. That's such good advice. We're speaking with Amy Nathan. The name of her book is Making Time for Music: How to Bring Music into Your Busy Life. Let's go to Tori. Tori's calling us from the Upper West Side. Hi, Tori.
Hi there. I was so excited to hear this topic introduced. I am 72 years old. I have returned to choral singing recently, like 5 years ago. And I find I'm challenged by how to actually practice the material that my choir is working on. And I wonder if your guest has any suggestions about where can I go to get advice about how to do the work? I'm retired. I have no time constraints at all. But I don't know. When I'm sitting here, I don't know what to do. Hmm. I don't know how to practice. Well, and it's a weird situation, but I would like for the time I spend with my music to be, more productive.
Okay. Amy, advice.
Well, I would think that probably your choral director has you all do warm-ups before you start singing. So tape them. Next time you go to a chorus rehearsal, tape the rehearsal and then play it back and do those same warm-ups and sing along in the rehearsal. The other thing is you can, just about any piece you're probably going to be playing, you can find a YouTube video of it, or on the J.W. Pepper music retailer site, you can find practice tracks and just sing along with them. I mean, that can really help a lot. But there are also online courses for ear training, which can really help a singer to really learn how to sing the thirds, the fifths, all the different intervals. So there's a lot you can learn online.
And that's also, thank you for calling, Tori. That's also a great way in terms of people who are thinking, I really can't afford to take lessons right now. The internet's an incredible resource, it sounds like.
Oh, definitely. It definitely is. Yeah.
One of the things I also think is important before, as we wrap up this conversation, is to talk about aside from the community you can become a part of when you're an amateur musician, it's really good for your brain
as
an adult.
Oh, it definitely is. Right.
Explain to folks about what it does in terms of your executive functioning.
Right, right. So Nina Krause, who's one of the prime researchers in this field, says that making music is the healthiest thing you can do for your brain, because making music is a multitasking experience. So you're using the physical, you're reading, you're planning, you're listening, you're coordinating with others. And so making music lights up more areas of your brain than just about any other activity. And so all those different areas of your brain have to communicate with each other, and that creates new neural pathways in your brain. And the idea is that those new neural pathways, and this is the good thing, may provide what's called cognitive reserve, which means when the cognitive decline of aging kicks in, you'll have these new neural pathways that can help you figure out how to do other things. So there's all these brain benefits for music, but that's not the real reason to do it.
The real reason is because it's fun and you love it. Amy Nathan, Thank you so much for joining us in studio. The name of the book is Making Time for Making Music, How to Bring Music into Your Busy Life. Amy, thank you for joining us on All of It.
Thank you for inviting me.
You've been listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We'll see you on the other side of the news.